Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll put some context around the numbers, perspective around the politics, and some clarity around the choices facing us in South Africa. A warm welcome. I'm Jeremy Mags. Coming up on the program today, Treasury responds to South Africa's first Fitch upgrade since 2005, but can fiscal discipline hold? Xenophobia returning to the headlines, but is immigration really the issue or just the trigger? The World Cup starts this week and cyber criminals are already targeting fans online. And new data shows where South Africans are still spending and where they are cutting back. It's Tuesday, the 9th of June. Now, you'll be aware that South Africa has secured its first Fitch ratings upgrade since 2005. And I think it's an important signal that fiscal discipline, primary budget surpluses, better revenue collection, debt stabilization are starting to count. But I think there's also a harder question. It's whether this is a genuine turning point or maybe just a simple, small reward for stopping the slide. Joining me now is Jim Matsimela, who's Chief Director for Strategy and Risk Management at the National Treasury. Jim, a very warm welcome to you. Let me get the broad assessment here. Is the upgrade a real economic turning point, or are we in danger perhaps of over-celebrating a move that still leaves us two notches below investment grade?
I think to your question or to your point, this rating upgrade has been long in coming. And it's a celebration, it's a cause for celebration. And I would venture to say that it's not just a mere mention of, you know, a few things that the government said it has achieved. It is actually a confirmation that government remains committed to sound public finances in line with our government response. And this is evidenced by running primary surpluses for a period of 3 years in a row. And we continue to implement structural reforms that ensure that we support higher and inclusive economic growth, and which essentially underpin investor confidence.
Jim, let me pick you up then on primary budget surpluses, if I can. The upgrade rests heavily on that, from what I understand. Do you think those surpluses, though, can survive political pressure for higher wages, bailout, social spending, and particularly in a year where we have local government elections?
They will definitely survive that, Jeremy. I don't think at the end of the third year, experiencing the surpluses, when we started with the plan, there was an expectation that perhaps we would perform better as we did. But I think running this for a period of 3 years in a row without fail, I would say that even going into a cycle or an election cycle year, there is nothing that will derail our plans to achieve, the primary surplus as we plan to.
Jim, on a macro level, Fitch praising prudent fiscal management, but I think it's fair to say that ordinary South Africans still see weak growth. They see high unemployment. They also see collapsing services in many respects. How do you explain the upgrade to someone who feels no improvement in their daily life?
Well, for a small digression, Jeremy, just allow me. I think in a worst case or a worst but rare case scenario, such as when government defaults, I think we can agree that the taxpayers tend to be, or the society at large tend to be the ultimate bearer of the cost of default, whatever the cost, whatever the nature of the default is. And I think that when it comes to the South Africans, it's just unfortunate that it happens at the time when certain social issues happen to be on the radar. But I would even say that for an ordinary South African, this should be beneficial. As a DG said in one of the engagements, This rating upgrade should actually, first of all, lower our borrowing cost for government, for businesses, and for households alike. So I think they also stand to benefit in some way as we all celebrate this momentous rating upgrade, Jeremy, in my view.
But it's not going to be immediate benefit, though, is it?
The benefits tend to flow rather slow, isn't it, as investment, as reforms, you know, take longer to also show some results. But I think we are on an upward trajectory, which we can confidently say that the rating agencies have been watching this over time. It has been so many years, Jeremy, that they've been pressing us on these structural reforms. And now they are seeing the turning points and they are confirming that to say that I think in the foreseeable future, you are on the right track, and this confidently we can upgrade you this time around, having not done so for so many years.
Jim, Treasury says fiscal consolidation is gaining traction, but maybe explain to us what specifically has changed in the way that government is spending money rather than simply benefiting from better revenue collection.
I think if you look at the expenditure side, Jeremy, I'm speaking for specialists who are very much in the Treasury and doing this on a daily basis. But if you just look at the discipline that we have instituted, you look at the way the wage bill has been de-risked, which is a major expenditure item as far as we are concerned. So I think we would safely say that when it comes to spending, especially with regard to the wage bill, that has been largely de-risked, and it has been also flagged by the rating agencies, and even our Treasury officials have advanced that cost to say, I don't think when it comes to the wage bill, or at least the expenditure pressures emanating from the wage bill, there is so much of a risk there, and they can see themselves because unions and government have arranged or they've gone into a wage agreement that will make sure that we don't increase wages beyond inflation. Even if there were such a case were to happen, at least I think there has been some de-risking on that part.
Isn't the single biggest problem that you have to grapple with, though, is while investors may like the direction that Fitch is giving us, municipalities are failing. I think that's common cause, or many municipalities are failing. Infrastructure is under pressure. Service delivery for many South Africans is deteriorating. Jim, surely Treasury worries that local government can undo this national fiscal credibility that you're talking about.
Treasury is worried, but if you look at some of the responses that the minister has given recently, Jeremy, I think to the comfort of South Africans, certain measures that I think the government, the Treasury, along with other ministries have instituted, I think there is a cause for not worry, for not extremely being worried. Yes, I think we should admit that there are certain challenges and they continue to be visible. But I think the measures that have been brought about recently should actually bring some comfort that I think there should be some discipline in financial or sustainability on financial issues pertaining to municipalities going forward.
So in that respect then, and this is a final question to you, what's, as we look ahead, what's the single thing do you think that could derail the next upgrade? And what does Treasury need to do to convince Fitch?
I think one thing that we need to spell out quite loudly, Jeremy, is they need to see a sustainable reduction or rather stabilization in the debt path. So if we loosen the levers on stabilization, Jeremy, I can assure you that I think we may just as well go back to square one. But I think pulling up on those levers, I think that will ensure that at least we maintain the current, if not actually seeing some upgrades in the near future. So we are confident that on that basis, we will achieve some upgrades in the near future if we keep on that.
Jim Matsimela, thank you very much indeed. He's the Chief Director for Strategy and Risk Management at National Treasury. Thank you very much.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
President Ramaphosa, as you know, has moved to toughen South Africa's response to illegal migration, promising dedicated immigration courts, stronger border controls, a crackdown on corrupt officials and employers who exploit undocumented workers. But he's also warned sharply against xenophobia and vigilantism, saying immigration law must be enforced by the state, not by mobs or self-appointed community groups. I think the deeper question, though, is why the issue keeps returning with such force and whether migrants are becoming the visible target for much bigger failures around jobs, around crime, around services and broader trust in government. It's an important issue and I want to discuss it with Professor Darryl Glaser, a political commentator. He's attached to Wits University here in Johannesburg. Professor, a very warm welcome to you. And when South Africans express anger over undocumented migrants, are we hearing, do you think, a genuine conversation or debate around immigration or just displaced rage about the issues that I mentioned, like unemployment, crime and a failing government?
I think a lot of it is that displaced rage, Jeremy. I think that South Africans suffer something, I suppose, that a lot of people in many different countries do, which is a perception which is may or may not be grounded in reality, that they are being displaced by or losing out to foreigners. South Africans are far from unique in this. And, you know, the mass movement of people across the boundaries of states has become a major source of instability, especially for democratic states. So, and especially democratic states that are, successful enough to attract immigrants looking for better lives. So, I think what's interesting is that, you know, for a long time, a lot of this reaction was very much localized, very much coming up from below. The elites were quite disconnected from popular sentiment around this. And to some extent, they still are. The elites are still rather sort of helpless and reactive. But I think what we've seen that is somewhat ominous is sort of larger scale organizations trying to exploit and mobilize this xenophobic sentiment.
If that's the case, Darryl, then it becomes that much more difficult, doesn't it, to separate legitimate concerns about illegal immigration from the prejudice against foreign nationals that we are seeing increasingly happen?
I think that's absolutely right. I don't think there is a rational debate. I mean, you could say that every state has some right to regulate its borders. On the other hand, you could say, well, the world has been rather arbitrarily divided into nation states, and some people find themselves on the lucky and others on the unlucky side of borders, and one has to have some compassion for people who flee in pursuit of better opportunities. It's just a natural thing for humans to do, and we have to find a way of reconciling those various imperatives, the need to take care of people, to show compassion for people. And of course, we have to maintain the rule of law, which, on the one hand means that state bureaucracies must not be corrupt and inefficient in regulating borders. But it also means that citizens mustn't take the law into their own hands. And they have to also learn how to deal with outsiders in ways that are compassionate, and I think we're not in that space at the moment.
Do you think we can get there, or have we left it too late?
I think we've left it rather late in the day. I think we have a state which is just not very well equipped to deal with these matters. I mean, Cyril Ramaphosa, on this issue, as with COVID, I think he talks quite a good talk when finally he gets around to saying what he needs to say. But, I just think there's been this boiling rage at the grassroots of South African society, which people in like you and me in academia and the media and so on struggle to fully grasp. And there should have been, I think there's been some denialism about the extent of xenophobia. Like Acton Mbeki, who you remember famously or notoriously said that South Africans are not xenophobic, but they often are, and that's something that perhaps should have been addressed from much earlier on.
So we had this weekend speech on television, this strategy that he announced, including immigration courts and stronger border controls. Darryl, I'd suggest to you that we've heard all of this before. Do you think it's going to make any difference this time around?
Look, I think a general sense that kind of popular rage around this issue is building up may force the government to tinker around the edges. I think it very much remains to be seen both whether there's the will and perhaps more importantly, the capacity to really regulate borders. Don't forget that even wealthy and relatively efficient states struggle to regulate borders and to deal with popular dissatisfaction around this. And our state is neither wealthy nor particularly well-capacitated.
And Daryl, your view on the rhetoric that we hear, the role that political parties and public figures play in hardening attitudes, even when they claim they're just talking about law enforcement, that is not helpful, is it?
No, well, I think the situation's got worse in that respect, as I was suggesting earlier. I think there was a time in the past where we could, to some extent, be distinguished from many other states where we didn't actually have a leading political party or a prominent political party that was exploiting the immigration issue as the central issue. But I think we're now moving into a politics where you are increasingly going to get opportunistic political operators who do exploit that issue. And I think that could have worrying consequences.
Professor Daryl Glaser, thank you very much.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
The FIFA World Cup has not even kicked off, but cyber criminals, I read, are already on the pitch. Now, there's new research that warns that fraudsters, ransomware gangs, and fake app operators have spent months preparing for the tournament, targeting the money, travel, and digital behavior that obviously comes with a global event like this. And for African fans, many of whom will experience the tournament online rather than in stadiums, the risks range from fake streaming apps and counterfeit merchandise sites to look-alike travel platforms, crypto scams, and stolen card details. It sounds like a real mess. Well, joining me now is Ian Janse van Rensburg, who's head of security engineering at Checkpoint Software Technologies, and they've just done the research. Ian, a very warm welcome to you. And when you say cyber criminals have, and in your words, arrived before the fans, what exactly have they built already or prepared ahead of the tournament?
So one thing I do want to just start off with is to make your listeners aware that the World Cup creates a unique concentration of online activity. It's millions of people, you know, are buying merchandise, booking travel, purchasing tickets, streaming matches, placing bets, and interactive on social media, all within a short period of time. Now, you know, something like the FIFA World Cup is announced long before the time. These cyber criminals are aware of it, and they are, preparing to go out and scam people and take their money. And seeing that there's so many people that's preparing to buy merchandise, book travel, purchase tickets, and all these things, it's really a soft target for them to create what we call phishing sites. They can also create fake websites, fake payments, fake merchandise to catch people out.
And of that list, what do you think the biggest danger is, particularly for fans at home who are not lucky enough to be in the United States or Mexico or Canada?
I think, you know, most South Africans or people in Africa will experience the tournament digitally rather than attending in person, which means their biggest risk comes from what we call fake websites, fake mobile applications, phishing messages, and social media scams. These days, cyber criminals make use of artificial intelligence, or as everyone is talking about AI now, to create phishing sites and fake websites for them. It's almost like cyber criminality is a business these days, not just a guy sitting with a dark hoodie on.
And Ian, the real worry here is these fake platforms that you reference are fairly convincing. I think we're probably past the point, are we not, where people can simply spot scams maybe because of clumsy design or bad spelling, for instance.
Correct. I mean, it's not just the people, the fans that's out there going online to purchase travel and so forth. It's really businesses should be paying close attention Major sporting event creates opportunities not only for the consumer, but also for business, email compromise, invoice fraud, phishing campaigns, and also brand impersonation. If a brand is impersonated and someone think that they're actively dealing with the real business, and they're not, that can be very deceiving, and people should be very very aware of it. So, organizations involved in payments, travel, hospitality, communication, and financial services are particularly attractive targets because attackers know those sectors will experience increased activity and pressure during the tournament period.
Is the suggestion that FIFA, maybe the sponsors, banks, and even travel platforms are not doing enough then to protect consumers, or do you think too much responsibility is pushed onto the individual fan?
Look, I think awareness is the most thing that that can be done. It's FIFA themselves can't be held responsible for everyone out there. It's just too much. There's too many companies, too many businesses, too many websites that's out there. So I would say, without looking at at FIFA themselves, consumers must be very aware that, if they're downloading apps, that it's only from official sources. Don't click on links received through unsolicited emails, SMSs, and so forth. So it's really about awareness. And, if I can really give people out there the best advice. If it seems too good to be true, then don't go for it. Number one. Number two, I know in these type of situations, you might get tickets or so forth. You want to move fast. You want to act quick. When you feel like you're pressured and pushed into a corner, stop and think twice.
It's good advice, but I guess it's advice that many people will fail to heed because they just get caught up in the moment. Ian, the report also mentions crypto scams. What are you hearing?
Yes, correct. There is, a lot of the companies these days accept cryptocurrency for specific deals and so forth. So, crypto scams is also out there in the sense of, they will accept cryptocurrency, and it could be fake cryptocurrency that is being pushed across. So, definitely, I would say if people are paying for either tickets or something online, please make sure that it's the correct website, it's an official website, and it's been approved. Don't just let your Bitcoin or anything else go to an environment or to a company that that's not legitimate.
And Ian, just a final one on the travel side for people who might be lucky enough to go, should they be caught out? There's a real risk here for fans on match day, whether they get their hotel room, whether the airline booking is correct, or whether the ticket that they have on their mobile phone or physically in their hand actually is the right one.
Correct. The best thing to do is to definitely be extra vigilant. Most of these people, they want to see it or experience it also in person. And when you're booking a ticket or you are online, make sure that you download that application from the actual Apple Store or the Play Store on Google or the Apple iStore. Ensure that it's coming from there. Also, make use of you can also go type in those details on Google and make sure that those sites are the correct sites. And I would say do that beforehand. Don't wait until the last minute, and then all of a sudden you get tickets and you're pointed to the wrong site, because when it's too late, I'm afraid these guys are already got it in hand.
Ian Janse van Rensburg is Head of Security Engineering at Checkpoint Software Technologies. Ian, thank you very much.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
South African consumers may be under pressure, but tills I see are still ringing. New data from Nielsen IQ shows that shoppers spend something in the region of $173 billion on fast-moving consumer goods in Q1 of this year, with sales value up 6.5% and unit sales up 9.1%. We're going to tell you what the difference is in just a moment. Traditional trade, I read, including spazas, taverns and independent superettes, those small mom-and-pop shops on the corner, continue to outperform in key categories, while shoppers are trading down in things like technology and durables, as big-ticket purchases, I guess, are becoming a lot harder to justify. So a lot of information in the study. I'm in conversation now with Lene Klopper, who's consumer panel lead at NIQ South Africa. Lene, a very warm welcome. Just from your perspective then, what's the big headline that you've pulled out from this first quarter retail data?
Well, from the first quarter, we had a lot more breathing room in the early months of 2026. So consumers were able to spend a little bit more freely, and that resulted in some really good growth that was ahead of inflation, in fact. So like you said, 6.5% in value and 9.1% in units. Knowing that, we saw some really good growth coming through that was driven by, as you said, traditional trade and certain categories and certain behaviors that we saw. But we do know that the conflict in the Middle East is going to cause things to really change over the next few months.
Yeah, those dark clouds are gathering very quickly on the horizon. But explain this to me. I see a bit of a disconnect. So if we are supposedly under pressure, how do we explain that unit and value growth, do you think?
Well, unit growth is the amount of units that's being purchased, and value growth is the price that is purchased at. So value growth could be very much influenced by price. If there have been price increases, you could see value growth. And the fact that unit growth is sitting so high could be that some consumers are down trading and buying more units more frequently, but in smaller pack sizes. We have seen with our global outlook that there is quite a strong divide in that sense. So there are a lot of consumers that will make smaller purchases more frequently so that their outlay per trip is less. But then you also get some consumers that will upsize into bigger pack sizes, because then the cost per volume is lower for the consumer. And that could be the same consumer could have different behavior amongst different categories. So that's why we see both value and unit growth going up.
Now, obviously, all of this data compiled before the latest CPI numbers. But what's your sense? Is this mainly then looking back a softer inflation story? Or do you have the sense that with the constraints that you've already outlined to me, shoppers are genuinely buying a little bit more, or were buying a little bit more?
We see that there was softer inflation and also very aggressive promotions. It's quite a scary fact, actually, that most brands sell most volumes on promotion. We have seen some brands selling as much as 80% of their volumes on promotion. We know that the South African consumer is highly price sensitive, so chasing those promos is what we do. And it's always nice to buy something at a lower price than what we know we can normally get it at. And we also know that from a household panel perspective, well, 64% of categories have seen a decrease in penetration. And we also saw that 50% of categories saw a decrease in consumption. So that does show us that households are rationing their baskets. And we know going into this year, consumers were already very cautious. So for the outlook of this year, we expect further rationalization, and also using items a lot more sparingly.
So, Lene, that's all the macro data. Let's get to some of the more fun stuff now. Let's look at which particular FMCG categories, that's fast-moving consumer goods, tell us most about how households are coping.
What we've seen is that snacking is doing really well. This could also be attributable to the channel traditional trade contributing towards snacking's growth, because we know that snacking is quite a big category within traditional trade. But snacking and beverages doing well. And if you make that trade-off, knowing that most consumers are back at the office up to 5 days a week now, we know that consumers are out and about a bit more. And if you had to make the trade-off of buying a meal while you're out at work or seeing friends versus buying a snack and a beverage, the snack and the beverage is a lot easier on the consumer wallet. So snacking doing very well. I guess snacking is also maybe a little bit of a comfort category in tough times that we lean towards. That snacking doing very well. We know that liquor and tobacco also are two categories that see growth. And baby, interestingly enough, is one of the categories that has been seeing declines come through.
Yeah, let's talk about, as you speak and you talk about snacks and beverages performing strongly, I like the observation that it's a small, affordable indulgence. Linnea, I feel a Kit Kat coming on as we have this conversation. But interestingly, baby food and baby care declining, is that a warning sign about real household stress? How do you read that?
Well, baby is quite a niche category. There are some categories that can be used across different members of the household. So in some instances where you can use a product for both the adults and the baby, households would be rationing rather than buying baby-specific products. And that could be one of the cost-saving strategies that households are employing.
What's also interesting are spaza shops and independent stores, those superettes, as I call them. They are winning. Is it because of price? Is it convenience? Is it smaller baskets? What do you read into that?
It's all of the above. So traditional trade is a really interesting topic at the moment. We know that our universe estimate for FMCG on traditional trade is around 150,000 outlets, whereas modern trade only has about 10,000 outlets. So there is significantly more opportunity for consumers to go purchase from traditional trade based on where the outlets are. And we do know that there's more categories being sold in traditional trade. So what we've seen is that you're able to buy a bigger basket rather than just your top-ups that you would have normally bought from traditional trade. And what a lot of consumers do is they do their modern trade purchasing, but then top up from traditional trade, and now they've got more variety. So they can do one big grocery shop in modern trade and then go to traditional trade throughout the rest of the month. We do know that the price gap has also narrowed between traditional trade and modern trade. Previously, we knew traditional trade to be a lot more expensive. But because of the competition amongst wholesalers and retailers for supplying this channel, we've seen that that price gap has narrowed.
Also very interesting, a real window on consumer behavior. Linnea Klopper, thank you very much indeed, consumer panel lead at NIQ South Africa. And on that note, we'll end today's program. You have been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday, and we're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.